One thing I wanted to ask about was the way in which you assimilate food. You said it was similar. You assimilate out of the food what was similar to yourself.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about the way in which you tend to group with similar people.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if there was a link there kind of made in this constant gathering of similars.
Yeah. But can you see logically why only like substances can assimilate? You know, for instance, if you take the organic compounds, you're really dealing with nitrogen compounds, aren't you?
Oh, yes, it is.
You must have something that is in some way similar to many things if you wish to bind a lot of things together.
Is that like the catalyst again?
Similar, except that in the catalyst you have a substance that doesn't itself take part in the reaction. It's just its presence that determines it. Like we said before, that consciousness is a catalyst. If you see a child playing and it doesn't know that you have noticed it and you keep looking at it, very soon the child alters the character of the play. It's aware that it's under observation, and the fact that it is being watched changes the character of the action. And the same thing happens as any human being. The moment he becomes conscious of what he is doing, then the action tends to change itself. Consciousness in that sense is a catalyst, because consciousness does not itself participate in anything whatever. It is just the permanent background of all the activities. You can say, if you like, that everything, every percept is inside consciousness. The consciousness itself is not of them, but they are of it. They're like the ripples on the sea. The ripples can fall down and leave the sea there calm. You can imagine the sea calm without ripples, but you can't imagine the ripples without the sea, which establishes the priority of substance, doesn't it? This is well to make a if we draw ourselves a wave and a body of water, we can say that the body of water represents substance, plastic substance, and these waves now are the basis of the possibility of counting. If we draw another body of water here, calm, we say that is one surface, don't we? Because it is flat. At the moment waves come in, we can start counting the waves. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. This is like the tooth side of a saw. We call this the discrete aspect. Discrete means grown apart. This is the discrete aspect of the phenomenal world. There is the substantial world, whatever it might be, all this stuff, as we call it in the Anglo-Saxon. This is the materia of the Latins, the stuff, substance, the hema or wood of the Greeks. And this is the carving of the wood, or the rippling of the plastic substance. Here we have continuity on the bottom. Ships may pitch and toss, and sailors may complain up there as much as they like. Down below, a sunken ship is in calmness, isn't it? This is very, very similar to the human mind. The ripples in the human mind are caused by forces acting on the mind from outside, which we call stimuli. But in the depth of the mind, the stimulus from outside cannot produce great disturbances. Which means that fundamentally everybody is quite calm. Would you like to put that in again? So that it works. I had another one over there somewhere. Yeah. Anyhow, this question of assimilation now, we know that unless a substance has some factor identical with another substance, it cannot fuse with it. I suppose we consider that all matter is vibrating in a certain way. We can then, if we like, say some matter has a characteristic wave form like that, and there's its baseline from which it starts. Now, supposing we take the string of a musical instrument, this is how Pythagoras would have done it, and we allow that string to vibrate, supposing we pull it down there, and then let it fly across, it will then assume this position, and then that position, won't it? And it will give a beat that we call the fundamental. But if we stimulate this string in various ways, plucking it, a wave will break through the middle there. We can put a finger there on a violin string, and we will then get, if that finger is halfway from there to there, we'll get the octave of this fundamental note. That means if that fundamental is, say, middle C on the piano, then putting the finger halfway along it will give you the C above it, which has double the frequency. Which means if we take this character, we can reproduce it here, and say that the wavelength of that is half as long as that, but the frequency is double. This question of assimilation is very closely linked, because in effect it means that if we take the universe itself as a big sphere, and take the diameter of it as the fundamental, then we can say there is a definite vibration which to the appropriate tympanum, to the appropriate sensitive organ, say the divine ear, would sound a fundamental. And then if we divide it in the middle and stop it here, there would be an octave higher sounding there and there on both sides, which we would call musically a parcel. And if we stopped this again half here, this would be an octave higher than this one, and half again, that would be an octave higher, half an octave higher still. This is going up into smaller and smaller divisions. And we see that the wavelengths of these parts are getting shorter. So we can then say that if we take this as the whole universe, and that is the diameter of it, and then proceed to subdivide it until we can no longer divide it anymore, we have reached the shortest wave in the universe. Haven't we? So we could then make a gamut of waves, the longest wave, the full diameter of the universe, and the shortest wave would be something like Schrödinger's wave at all. Somewhere on the other side of the electron. Very, very tiny wave, very short wave, of very high frequency. There are many of those per second of time. So, supposing we say that if we make some food, we'll draw a circle here, we say food is just something that can be assimilated. You see the difference between the word good and food? It's G and F, isn't it? Now this concept, ud, or ad ed, means to eat, in the root in edible. The Sanskrit ad is also the same thing, ud. We say food, food. Good means the gross matter of food. So we say we get something, is it good for you? You put it inside, and send it down there, break it up, and if you can assimilate it and come out better, you call it good. But if instead of being able to assimilate it, it starts disrupting you, you call it a poison. So we can see that this circle can be assimilated by this big one because it's half the fundamental. So it has a natural resonance, doesn't it? And we could say that there's another one in here that could be assimilated by this one. And halfway there's another one. And there's another one. There's another one. You can see that all these small frequencies can be absorbed by the big one, can't they? But if we go on cutting these down in this manner, we'll find that some of them will not assimilate with each other because of the relation between odd and even counts. When we cut that, we get 2. We cut it again, 4, 8, 16. We haven't got something yet that we can divide by 3, have we? You see that? So if we go on up and up and up, we find that the odd numbers will not assimilate with the even. You know, Pythagoras said odd numbers are male, which means that they are active. Even numbers are balanced, equilibrated, and therefore feminine. Number 5, he said, means marriage, because it contains 2 and 3. The female number 2, first female number, the equilibration, balance, gives passivity, doesn't it? Perfect equilibrium is the same as passivity. And an odd number is a stimulus. There's an odd one in 3. 1 itself is not odd, that's the whole that we begin with. You see, the funny thing about elementary arithmetic is that the behaviour of 1 and 2 are not like the behaviour of other numbers. We say 1 plus 1 equals 2, and 2 times 1 is 2. So whether you add or multiply 1, you get the same result, don't you? But if we take the number 2, we say 2 times 2 are 4, and 2 plus 2 are 4, you see, and that behaves like 1, doesn't it? The same result whether you add or multiply. But when we come to number 3, if you say 3 plus 3 is 6, and 3 times 3 are 9, so suddenly there's a new emergence. And therefore there's a special kind of mathematics for dealing with the peculiar behaviour of 1 and 2. So 1 and 2 must be considered as, first, this big one, the one, the whole one, and all these are parts. Now the word part itself is a rational cut of pirat. And that pi ratio is the function. You see, here's the radius, and this is a parat, a part. The parrot, the parrot bird is so called because it says things parrot. Yeah. Rationally rotating them, whatever you feed in, it plays back. If we keep cutting this in 2 and 2, we will always find that this half can be assimilated by this and this and this. But when we divide it in 3, we get a note which in music is called a fifth. It's strange that they should call it a fifth, but it's really a third of the length of the string. But there is a way of reconciling that. But the point is that that third will not vibrate harmoniously with that half. So that it cannot be assimilated by it. But if we take factors of odd and even numbers and build them up, we can arrive at a number that can assimilate both odd and even, can't we? So, well, supposing we take 3 5s. Now, that will assimilate 2 odd numbers, 1, 2, 3, and 5. If we take 3 4s, it assimilates an even number and an odd number. So there's something mysterious about 12, isn't there? Because it can assimilate an odd and an even number. We're excluding 1 and 2 because they're special cases. The reason why they're special cases, this is 1. 1 inside and 1 outside. That makes 2. The 1 outside is infinite. And the one inside is finite. So 1 and 2 are very, very special cases. But from the point of 3 onward, the first synthetic number, 1 isn't synthetic, it's unanalyzed. The first synthetic odd number is 3. And the next is 4, and 3 times 4 is 12. So in 12 we have a means of assimilating short frequencies derived from the third and from the half. You can cut the half into a half, quarters, 8, 16, and the third into 6, 12, and so on. So this question of the fundamental beat of matter is very important. If we wanted to, we could cut that into 13 times 7 plus 1, which would give us the atomic scale, namely 92 elements, ignoring isotopes for the time being. When we come down to the smallest particle, it is a definite subdivision of the diameter of the universe, which means to say that it has a definite resonance relation with other parts of the universe. That means that there is something in man, namely his physical body, which is made of the earth, which is made of primary elements vibrating at definite wavelengths, which are necessarily related to the planetary cycle, the whole mass of matter in the solar system, and to an octave structure, the sun itself, and then to the sidereal system, and then to the whole universe. So
so that their matter is no more than a series of subdivisions right down to the smallest subatomic particle there is, which has a definite periodicity function, a definite frequency of its own and a wavelength. And the whole question of assimilation, therefore, is fundamentally one of frequency. If we get a saw and we make its teeth like this, and we get another saw with the teeth exactly the same pitch, they fit. If we get another saw where the teeth don't fit, then it cannot assimilate. We can't put them together. Now, in the case of measuring on a vernier, we have this sort of sawtooth, don't we? And a finer sawtooth. And at some point, there will be a coincidence. There's one there on here accidentally. And the rest of them will be out. Now, if you remember, we said before, if you take the six-pointed star and put a five-pointed star in it, if we put one point of the five on one of the six, the rest are out of phase. So you can assimilate through one sense when you are concentrated, and therefore not through the others at the same time. So fundamentally, we can say that this question of assimilation is one of frequency, and that every particle of food that you eat, every drug, every chemical, is made of fundamental frequencies that must go into their own places somewhere along this diameter line of the universe. Now, what we call thinking in a man is really formal presentation, serially, isn't it? For instance, if we say, think of a cube as a cube, now that is an image. Plato would have said that's the lowest kind of thinking there is, because it's imposed on us. When we see that, we can tell that that peculiar thing isn't the same as a crescent. And we cannot be deceived by that to think that it's that. It doesn't allow us to do so. So in that sense, we are slaves if we work at the sense perception level. Because perceiving, say, these compasses close, and then we open them, it's not very smart to be able to tell that they're open when we do this and closed when we do this. It's an imposition. So man's freedom does not consist in the sense world, because the sense world merely reflects what there is outside. This is why she said that man's freedom is within. Man is not free in his relation with the external world, because it imposes upon him, giving him the so-called sense data, which are what they are, whether he likes it or not. So we've got this idea that assimilation is fundamentally no more than the actual resonance of already related partials of a string, which in its widest sense may be called the diameter of the universe. Now, when a person is thinking, there is also a definite frequency in his mind. If he looks at the light imposes on him. If he looks for a long time, and then looks against a dark curtain, he will then see an after image from the light begin to superimpose itself. If you look at the light until it fills your eye with light and you begin to see colours around it, and turn into a dark place, the light will form itself, and you will then find that it will start drifting about. And with a little bit of practice, you can cause it to come near to you, which is a very peculiar thing. You can actually make it come very close so you can examine the details. Although it really was up there, you begin to have a certain amount of power over it, because you are now dealing with something that is half from outside and half from inside. And the nearer it is to your inside, the greater the degree of freedom you have over it. Now, every frequency has a very definite chemical characteristic. And you know that when we're examining the chemistry of stellar bodies with a prism, we use spectrum analysis to determine the presence of sodium or other elements in stars. If a surface reflects light to us, we can tell by the characteristic colours in the spectrum what chemicals are there. That is, of course, ordinary physical science. What is not usually realised is this, that an emotion is also a frequency, and it has a very definite relationship with particular material substances, a frequency relationship. such that if you eat certain food, you are absorbing frequencies which will tend to make you think and feel in a certain way. If you take certain, supposing we said that is a certain substance, and you eat it, well then all the partials, that is the seven divisions of that, will vibrate in you as well. And at the top level here, it is an identity of ideation, thinking and emotion. So that it is upon this that the restrictions about diet are based in yoga. Namely, that thought itself is a kind of motion with a definite frequency and wavelength, with definite relations to the foods that you eat. So that if you are in a certain mood, you can assimilate certain foods, and if you're in another mood, you may be unable to assimilate the same food. Sometimes you find a fellow saying, I've just been put off my food by so-and-so. He had a good appetite, and he was about to eat, and then up spake Spurius Lartius or somebody, and suddenly his appetite is gone. Now why? The food is the same, the man is the same, but a stimulus has come, stimulated something in his memory, and altered his fundamental frequency, so that now he cannot deal adequately with that food. If you persuade him to swallow it, it does not follow that his stomach can deal with it. It might lie very heavily on his stomach for a long time. So that really you have to tune yourself in to the food that you get.
But if for instance, you start to receive new ideas, it might start you to want to eat different kinds of food.
Oh yes, well you know that in the case of a pregnant woman, don't you? You know that they have, they start thinking they want things that they didn't want before. And those are genuine things, they're not empty fantasies. They are chemical needs. There's a certain chemical need for making the child, which previously they did not themselves need because they hadn't got that kind of emotion. Sometimes a woman may think to herself, I'm such and such a being, and then suddenly she has a child and she thinks she's another kind of being because chemical changes have occurred. She may be all right to live at a certain level, and then when she changes her level emotionally, she changes her chemical need, because there is nothing in the universe, whatever it is, a gross material, subtle material, which is the mind itself is a very fine matter, and the soul feeling, the soul specifically is the sentiency, being, feeling, and spirituality are all matters of frequency. Whatever is has a definite beat, and the top beat of all is the beat that we call spirituality. Below that there is the psychic one, and then below that, smaller and smaller, we're concerned with the gradual appearance of these partials, which are gross matter as far as we're concerned. So that no matter what it is, you can think of it in terms of these teeth. Do they fit or do they not? Supposing we take all the people in this room who at the moment may be assumed to be interested in certain aspects of this subject. If they're interested in the same aspect, they must be using the same frequency. Sometimes in a spiritualist circle you get a request that everybody sits round and lets the finger of the hand, so the little finger touch the thumb of the next person, all sit in a circle and then all concentrate on one thing. Well, the purpose of doing that is to persuade the mind to beat in unison, because when you've got unity you have power. If you've got unity in your own being, you've got power. Whereas if you have too many purposes which cannot be logically related, then your power, although it is there, is dispersed in various directions and does not appear as effective power because it lacks unity.
I begin to see the idea now that if you're using up energy at a certain frequency, you're going to require to take out of the food to replace that energy at that frequency.
Yes, yes.
That's correct.
Well, it will be shown scientifically that if a man eats exactly the same food, supposing we say to a man, here's some mashed potatoes, and we mash them up to get a more or less homogeneous consistency, and then we divide them arbitrarily in half and say, now I want you to eat this half today, and I'm going to tell you funny stories while you eat it. And then we're going to take the excrement and measure the chemistry in it. And tomorrow you're going to eat the other half, and we're going to tell you horrible stories, not funny stories. And we'll do the same thing, and it will then be shown by resonance that the man has taken something out of the one that he hasn't taken out of the other. This is going on all the time. This is why you can't get the same diet to work for different people in the same way. This is why you can't get the same drug, which will give you, say, let's take penicillin, which is a wonder drug of the journalists. Yet, its percentage of successes, which is a statistical statement, is such, I think about 4 years ago, it was about 15% of immediate success. This depends on the chemistry of the person that takes it. Giving a drug, giving any kind of treatment, whatever, where you introduce bodies from outside for assimilation, must take into consideration the type of the person that's going to receive it, this chemical type. Now, if you get a book like Culpepper's Herbal, the medicine of his day was one thing, but he was an unusual fellow, and he liked the old-fashioned way. Like Paracelsus did in many ways. In fact, Paracelsus invented this modern method of injecting metals into people for certain resonance reasons. No two people can assimilate the same substance in the same way. The same person cannot assimilate the same medicine in the same way in two separate hours.
So you can never be complete accuracy in medicine.
Well, that is why it is said to be now a statistical science. The 19th century dream that there was a definite number of material particles which, as I said, were fortuitously running about and producing accidentally a universe, and their velocities and directions being known, you should be able to write the history of the universe forwards and backwards. That was a dream. There's no correspondence at all with fact. They had never at that time seen atoms walking about and colliding and fortuitously getting together to make a frog or something. It was an assumption, a kind of dream, because the mind of man is always looking for a final explanation which, if he gets it, he thinks he can stop and fold his arms and that'll be the end of it. But the universe isn't like that. The universe is fundamentally a continuum of power, and because it is a continuum, the straight line, these things which science counts, because science is based on measurement and statistical measurement of that, these things can never tell you what's going on down here. The invention of an infinitesimal calculus is an attempt to deal with smaller and smaller and smaller distances between here, but it can't deal with nothing. There's an attempt in mathematics to deal with what are called infinite qualities. They borrowed a Hebrew letter, Aleph, and by using the term Aleph Nun, which means a number that when added, multiplied, or divided by itself to make precisely what it was the first time, namely zero, this is an attempt to get down to this substratum. Most people think it is meaningless, but it isn't. It's an attempt to discover why this baseline can produce these ripples. Why does an egg become a human being? You look inside it with a microscope, all you can see is some little strings with knobs on. If in the old days they used to think that inside an egg was a little man waiting to have his dinner and grow big. It isn't true. Inside there are some little weird granules. But somehow they are the vehicle whereby a force outside them, namely the macrocosmic force, presses into that egg and produces a man out of it. Somehow the man isn't in the egg, he's outside the egg, but he gets into the egg by pressing on it and producing modulations, which fundamentally are frequencies. You take, say, the high bridge nose of the Jews as a race. that hybridness there is a product of haughtiness of spirit, of thinking high. Each nation has a definite psychological tendency which produces a physical structure, because the modeler of form is first feeling. First the feeling, then the function, then the ratification of the function in material. So that we can say about diseases in general, they begin with feeling slightly off colour. If the person becomes hypnotised by that, or begins to think it's useful to dodge some issue, then he starts working upon this feeling, and gradually he alters his substance and produces malfunctioning. If he produces this disturbance of function over a long time, he can make an organic breakdown. An organic breakdown doesn't just start like that. It starts by some functional disorder, which starts by some feeling disorientation to begin with. So that the more we can control and elevate the feeling and make it more positive, the more unity there will appear in the physical body. The whole point in yoga terms is to become ekacitta, have a one-pointed mind. Just have one aim and subordinate everything else to that. What contradicts it has to go. Now, Ken mentioned the zodiac, and while we're talking about assimilation, we can deal with that. This circle cuts itself spontaneously into the right number. Now, if we bisect the angles between these, there's our six pointer. That fits exactly. And we bisect these angles, we produce our 12 divisions. This is really a device which is fundamentally a new way of dealing with the macrocosmos, the big universe itself, and reducing it down to the level where it is useful to men. We draw one little circle and another and another and another for ease of analysis. We draw one circle and we'll put in it a triangle that way, and we'll write on it the sign of the ram, Leo, and Sagittarius there. And you see the ram is like a V, you probably know it. That is the so-called fire triad taken out, and actually refers to the nervous system of the human being. It means nervous energy. We invert that one and we put this triad in, and this is at the bottom Libra, and there Aquarius, and here Gemini. Now that's our air triad, which has to do with intellect, ideas, and the respiratory apparatus, the breathing apparatus in your body. Breathing is very closely linked with thinking, very closely linked with judgment. You know that when you start judging events, your breathing alters. If you decide that something is very, very bad and should be stopped, you'll find that your breathing begins to reflect your judgment. The Greek word for lungs is phren, which means mind. So they knew that there was a very close relation between thinking and breathing. And of course you can fire ideas at people and make them very excited, so that their breathing accelerates and they get palpitation. And yet you've only spoken to them. It shows the power of judgment over the breathing apparatus particularly. Now we have here the water triad. That's a triangle there with Cancer there. I better write this in the side. Right, 69 lying on its side, and that's the sign of Cancer. Scorpio down here, which is an M with an arrow on its tail, and then the sign of Pisces up there, which is two semicircles back to back, and then over here the final triad, Capricorn, which is the sign of the ram, plus the sign of Taurus. Taurus is the sign
This is a greasy thing that won't draw. Loop. And Virgo is like an M with the same loop added to it. I'll just show you those, they're a bit difficult. The sign of the ram is like that. The sign of Taurus is like that. If we add Taurus here to the ram, it's the sign of the goat, Capricorn. I'll explain why in a moment. There's Taurus on its own. We do a letter M, and then we put the sign of Taurus on the top of the sign. So in these three earth signs, we're using the sign of Taurus three times. And that's because that Taurus means to turn. Taurus, you see? That's rota. See? All matter is rotation of power. So when we're talking about the matter of your body, we're talking about rotations of power. And therefore, Taurus, this turning thing, you can spell that T-A-U if you like, or you can, this is a Hebrew way of spelling it. One way is Greek, if you spell it with an O there. It's Latin if you spell it with a U and an A-U there. But the fundamental concept is T-R, which is the rotor concept. So, in the case of the earth signs, to deal with your gross physical body, which manifests in the specifically in the bone structures, which are the nearest things to the mineral world, aren't they? They're the parts that when you get hold of a living human being and boil him until the flesh falls off, there's something that's still there, that's the bone. And that's the really earth part of you. The rest of the stuff, if you get a living man and heat him up, you'll drive off the most volatile substances first, and you'll find various sediments chemically afterwards. All those added together are the earth substances of the body. Now we'll consider what they are. I'm going to put I'll put the sign of the ram in here for a moment. Should have been at the top. We'll call that 12 o'clock. And then it goes round Taurus, Gemini, Cancer, Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio, Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces. Now I want you to think about this as a psychosomatic device. It tells you something about your mind and something about your body at the same time. When we come to consider the earth signs, that's Capricorn, Taurus and Virgo, we can see very clearly what it means. This means assimilation, absorption. This Capricornian, the goat, is the being that has a go at anything. You know that the symbol of the goat in the Old Testament is that person who throws himself into the situation and gets into trouble, and therefore we talk about the scapegoat. A being that pays the price of other people's carefulness in dangerous situations. There's always one that can't quite control himself and rushes forward first. And he is the one who is blamed, although everybody wants him to do the same thing. So this fellow who must have a go at is called the goat. And you know that the goats in general are not herded in the plains like sheep. They jump on the mountain tops. So that when it says the separating of the sheep and the goats in the Revelation, it means separating those independent spirits that are always trying to do it on their own from the mass spirit called sheep. And where the goats have to go and where the sheep have to go is not necessarily a bad thing. Goats, where the goats go, and that's where they like to go. It is called hell to sheep, because the sheep like to keep together. But the goats like to be independent. This is why Jakob Boehme says that the angel is called the good good, but the devil is called the bad good. So, this is your primary absorption of matter. So a person born with a stress on there is really pitched in this
necessity of absorbing matter through food. And this sign means secretion. It has to do with the glandular system. The food that you have absorbed, you now hide it in certain centers in the body, glands of internal secretion. And you store it there, and you let a bit of it out every now and then, it goes around the body. And this one has to do with the circulation of the food. So that's three processes: taking the food in, hiding the food in particular parts of the body, at the glandular system, and then circulating it to produce a balanced whole. Remember we said last week that the chemistry of the different parts of the human body, the blood, is not the same. The chemistry of the blood in the brain is not the same as the chemistry of the blood in your thigh muscles, because each part of the body has some substance being manufactured and poured into it at that part, so there's high saturation of a certain chemical from a gland, and far away there's less saturation than that, and something else is the dominant influence. So that the same chemical injected into one part of the body of the same man will not produce the same effect if you inject it into another part of the same man, because it's chemically different in different places. I mentioned Culpepper before. He said, it is no good knowing the right remedy unless you've got the right man to give it to, and it's time. And when he said it's time, he meant to say that there's a definite relation in resonance between something that most people today would tend to scoff at, but not modern scientists, they're very cautious now. Namely, that certain plants have definite relationships with certain planets. They were said anciently to be under the dominion of Mars, of Venus, and so on. We know that all vegetable life has very, very close statistical relationship with the planet Venus. We know that the coffee in Brazil is largely determined by the Venusian cycle. And we know that the moon itself has a profound effect on germination. This statistically, which is the same thing as saying scientifically. And the scientists, therefore, are today considerably less dogmatic about this. And he said, if a planet is ruling a certain plant, and you take that plant and abstract from it a certain chemical, and give it to a man who is antipathetic to that planet, it won't help him, it will annoy him. We talk about men as being, say, in ancient terms, we might have said a man is choleric. He's a man that tends to fly into bad tempers. He's an angry man, and so on. They had four types of men. And those four types are still valid, and they're involved in here, as we will see. The first, the absorption, taking in, the storing or secretion in particular places, then the rotation or circulation of those to maintain harmony of the body. That is for the physical things. We'll come back to them again in a minute. Now we take the water signs, so-called, which have to do with all the fluids in your body. All the fluid substances. And these are peculiarly related to your feeling. Just like the bones are a lever system related to your motor activities. So, the water signs are related to the fluids in your body. And when we start with cancer, it means the whole of the fluids in your body. When we talk about Scorpio, it means particulars. And when we talk about Pisces, it means, like Virgo meant, the circulation, again, the relating factor. So a person with this stress has a diffused feeling awareness, the cancer type. The Scorpio type has gathered his feeling together and is a very zealous man. Zeal is his essential characteristic. And the Pisces type is an emotional man. He's whizzing it round and it tends to fly out. There's a certain amount of unity in Scorpio, but it manifests as zeal and drive. There's a lot of disunity emotionally in Pisces. It tends to speak itself out in many, many diverse ways. But it's all to do with the fluids of the body and with the life of feeling. So that's like the psyche. These signs are like the gross physical body. This is like the soul life, the feeling life. When we come to the air signs, Libra means perception. Just like we said, taking in gross matter there, taking in fluids in general, we're now saying taking in sense data. First we must perceive. When we've perceived, then we unify them all in the memory. So that Aquarius, the so-called water carrier, water has plasticity. It is the form retainer. First perceive, then remember, then evaluate. So Gemini means judgment or evaluation. That's why we've got this two pillars, the right and left hand of the Solomonic temple. Whole perception, seeing as much as you can, storing it up in the memory, and judging from it. And that is the intellectual triad. It has to do with your breathing apparatus. As a matter of fact, if you try deliberately to perceive a lot of things, doesn't matter what they are, if you just took the contents of that table and tried to go around them and just seen them as quickly as you could, you'd find your breathing had accelerated. Maybe to try to do it. Although they're not particularly exciting things there, I don't think. Not any funny novels there. Nevertheless, if you actually tried to force yourself just to see them, you will start accelerating your breathing process. And that's very closely linked with your heart, which is the centre of your circulation system. Now, when we come to this trial, we get nervous energy as a whole, which would give a great belief in capacity, very quick mind, and tending to dominate, or hoping to dominate the situation, because they feel that they have the nervous energy to do so. But that's only the general feeling of it, not the particular. When we come into Leo, it has become gathered together into a ball, and therefore we say that Leo is the peculiar sign of willfulness. It is the sign of the will. And then we come here to that which balances these two. This is the individuated will, and that is the general, and this one goes in between both. So this one alternates between the undifferentiated nervous energy and the unified or volitional nervous energy. So that's shortly an explanation of the different parts. We'll go through them again now and look at the logic of it and see how useful it is for us if we can start off with a certain characteristic. Because this wheel was specially devised as a method of dealing with people with certain temperaments. Supposing we say, here's a person born in the sign of Gemini. We know, therefore, that he tends, I'm ignoring his heredity. Either or with them, and there's no end to it. The only way you can help that kind of person is to choose something they haven't thought of and rush them into it, which is the opposite sign. Now, the reply to every kind of behaviour is simply to play the opposite kind of behaviour. Supposing we take a person in the sign of Pisces, which is emotional activity, that is emotional activity, and straight opposite to it is Virgo. Now, the Virgoic type is solid, feels itself to be very reliable, is sure that it's the most reliable type of being that is, and in certain ways it is. And it has such a solid, stable centre in it that when emotional people are about, if a Virgo enters, it appears to be a centre of security. So the correct reply to an emotional person is not to join in and start pulling your hair out, but to go more Virgoic with yourself. Settle down and be very, very solid and think that you're made of matter. And thereby you contradict that emotional contagion. We could go around the whole circle, but it would take rather a long time to do it. I'd rather go back
and explain the logic of this process. First of all the energy in the universe before creation we may consider as a continuum. It is not synthetic because it has not yet been analysed, and we will call that the undifferentiated whole. So there's an undifferentiated nervous energy before it enters into a human being. So we can refer to that, the nervous energy, the kind of vibration that appears in a human being as nervous energy, is a definite frequency. And we call that a cardinal sign. I'll put C for cardinal. Now if we draw the George cross on here, like this, those are the cardinal signs. Undifferentiated nervous energy, the sign of the ram. Undifferentiated feeling, Cancer. Undifferentiated perception, Libra. Undifferentiated absorption of food, Capricorn. That's all undifferentiated, and that is prior to creation. But the moment that that force enters into a finite organism, like a human being, then it is no longer undifferentiated. It's like pumping air into a balloon. The air may be outside, undifferentiated. You pump it into the balloon, and straight away, if we draw the balloon inside there and draw the molecules of air that you pumped in, they're rushing about and colliding with each other and hitting on the inside of the skin and bouncing back. So that straight away they haven't got that absolutely free motion that they had outside. They are now conditioned by the fact of existing. This means to say that every force that gets inside a finite being, like a human being, like a stimulus, and a light stimulus, goes in your eye, goes in certain brain cells, but it comes to a term inside, the end of a nervous line, and it sets up a beat, and then the ripple starts all the way back again. So that in the unified state, that is the energy entered into a finite system, we pass then to the signs called fixed. And I've put here, the top sign there of the ram is undifferentiated. The opposite sign here was Libra, that's undifferentiated. Cancer is undifferentiated. And Capricorn, there's the George Cross. Now if we go clockwise, round one stage, we come to Leo. That is the first differentiation of it. And it is called a fixed sign, because the energy has now got itself fixed up in the body. Perception, passing in to a finite system, becomes memory. That is, every perception of light goes in, produces a modification in my brain, and my brain is never the same again. It has now been modified, and that modification is memory. So that the undifferentiated perception becomes memory when it enters a closed system like a human being. The undifferentiated feeling, when it enters a closed system, becomes zeal. Just in the same way if you pumped water into a balloon, this is the water triad, and pump it and pump it and pump it, at a certain point there will be a weak place in the skin of the balloon, and it will burst there and the water will shoot out. And that is the tendency of these feeling signs. When the feeling builds up to a certain level, something must happen. And in the case of the Scorpio stressed person, their whole life is driven from within by feeling. So that is then the fixed sign, Scorpio, and Taurus is the fixed sign for the earth. Remember, we take the undifferentiated food, put it in, break it down, and then hide it in glandular structures for use for distribution later. The first signs we call the undifferentiated or cardinal. The second ones we call fixed. And the third ones we call mutable. That is, they can change. They can either be undifferentiated or fixed, because they've already done both. This has to do with reincarnation. If you've done a bit of that, and you've done a bit of that, then you can rock between them and say, well, today I'm willful, tomorrow I'm reasonable, and so on. Whereas it's very hard for these beings to be reasonable or undifferentiated, because they've only just gained their unity. So we'll find that people stressed Leo are men of will. They're wonderful pioneers. They get things done. But they really cannot rest. They cannot not do things. Things must be done, and they must be done by them. So we have to see the logic of this, that whatever it is that exists must first exist prior to creation, which is its cardinal, its carbis hinge. It is upon that everything hinges, like its stone hinge. And then it must enter into a closed system, whereupon it reverberates inside the system, and then it must burst out of the system again to regain its freedom. So those are logically the three things: energy coming in. My pencil is refusing to cooperate. Energy swings in from infinity, turns round, that's the sign of Taurus, presses into its centre, and then shoots out again. That completes the whole process, doesn't it? Solar energy comes into a plant, and by means of the chlorophyll in its leaves, it synthesizes certain elements in the atmosphere, using the sunlight as its primary energy. And after a time, leaves come shooting out, fruits come shooting out, and then it sows its seeds about, scatter. So that is the logic. First, undifferentiated, non-creative, then the creative, packing in more and more energy, and finally, the outthrow. And it's very, very important to realize that in any situation whatever, for any kind of being, every finite being, every animal, every vegetable, every human being, is in a situation where forces are coming at him, piling into his organism, and will wind up inside until they're made such a pressure that they will come out, unless he understands how to control them. Now, in the case of sexual energy, we know it's perfectly obvious. Certain forces come into the body. They're not individual forces. They have no regard whatever for individuals. They come into the body. They're determined to procreate. They periodically build up. They build up all the time, but they periodically release. So they have to start building again. The energy comes in, piles itself up, until the chemical messengers from those centers going all over the body keep saying, "Go on. Go on, it's time to release this lot of new inhabitants of the earth." And therefore, the process called ejaculation or out-shouting must occur unless some method is devised of turning them in and transforming their frequency onto another level, which it is possible to do. Psychologically, that's called sublimation. A man wants to do various naughtinesses, instead of which he decides to build the Sydney single expansion bridge. Now that can be done with it. It's possible to create a work of art with the very, very same energy lifted to another level. But it has to be understood that you're dealing with infinite energy coming into a finite system, and it will shoot out in some form of symptom, unless you understand how to change its face. So we can say that from the moment a child is born, energies are piling into its food, solar radiation, cosmic radiations of various types, and they're forcing that child to grow. The child cannot refuse to grow at that level. It must grow because energy is coming in and packing it on the inside, and it will grow to the term for its type of being. And then energies start shooting out. And when a stimulus comes from outside and hits on an energy storage, the energy storage tends to react and throw more out. So a person may be practicing self-control for a few days and think, "I'm doing very, very well." And suddenly somebody says what is called the wrong word. And then quite suddenly it's apparent that that self-control was merely a bottling process. Now it says in the Book of Words, no man can be continent except God wills. Continent means containing. It means you cannot, as a finite system, contain all those energies unless God allows you to. And that can only be if you do with it what he wants you to do. That is a method of doing it. That is to say, you can take the same energy that would fire at a particular target and deliberately think of the macrocosmic being instead, which is equivalent to doing something that God wants you to do, and then you can contain the energy. It actually changes its frequency. You can then assimilate it at a higher level, and that which was a merely physical urge is then transmuted onto a higher ideational and emotional level. It will actually solve problems for you. The same energy that would get you into trouble can get you out, providing you shift your attention from the particular onto the universal. God is concerned with reminding all creatures that they are derived from the universal and trying to persuade them to behave as if there were only one whole being with many little children internal to it, like the seeds in a pomegranate. You know, the temple of Solomon had its pillars crowned with pomegranates to symbolize that, because the pomegranate is full of seeds and it's a kind of diagram of the universe.
365, according to Janet's paper, every one. I'm waiting to tell you that.
One for each day of the year. There should be a quarter one somewhere. Anyhow, we consider this as a diagram of the four systems in the body. We have four organic systems in the body, physically and also as a psychological device. Physically, it means there is nervous energy, there is breathing, there is feeling in the fluids, and there is absorption of food. Psychologically, it means there's a very definite relationship between willfulness and nervous disorders. Because this nervous energy is that energy which becomes will when it enters into a finite being. So that people that tend to be willful are the same people that tend to be neurotic. Now, if we take the opposite of fire, that's water. The water people, in general, with the exception of Scorpio, that is ruled by Mars, they are adaptable. And they do not tend to neurosis. What they tend to is something quite different. They tend to enjoy themselves and not be too particular about what are called this world's moral considerations. They tend to be hedonists, to enjoy life, to say that life is for pleasure and for the avoidance of pain. And if we can get on very, very nicely together, it's good enough for us. You can keep your air sign theory. Now, the air sign type, in general, hasn't got that kind of feeling, but prefers a process of judging everything, evaluating everything perpetually, and therefore tends to lack feeling. But if you remember, Plato said, feeling is the unity principle in your body, and thinking is the disunity principle. It is thinking that breaks you up. It's analytic. It is feeling one that will renew your wholeness. So it's very important to see the difference. Now, in the case of the earth kind, we can see an illustration of what psychologically is called psychothymia, where we divide people into two kinds, schizophrenics and cycloids. The air sign, the intellectual, tends to split up into subsidiary personalities, which is called schizophrenia. The earth sign tends to be alternately depressed and elated, but he keeps always his own personality. It is always Maggie Mumps who is depressed, you see, and elated, and depressed and elated. If we take the extreme case of this, the insane people who are cycloid, they tend to commit suicide after a depression has just finished. Never in it. Because when they're thoroughly depressed, they can't do anything about it. But if they've been depressed and then they've been elated and then they've been depressed and elated in a continuous cycle, they get fed up of returning to a depression that they're just escaping. So when they're coming out of a depression, they get enough energy to commit suicide before they have time to reach the peak of elation and become depressed again. So there's a definite period for the cycloid type when we have to watch them very carefully, because they tend to do away with themselves, not in the depth of a depression where most people would think, but when they are coming out of it. Burma's terms, it would be a warning to all earth signs to avoid depression. And the way to avoid depression is very simple mechanically. Never allow yourself to be elated, and you can never be depressed. You see, it's again this waveform. If you allow yourself to go, there's your median line. If you allow yourself to go up, that is, you push the string up there, it must fly down again. So this is the way to conquer depression. Because in depression you can do nothing at all except sit and be depressed. You wait until you tend to be elated and you pull down that elation, knowing that if you manage to pull it down, you cannot be any lower the median line in your depression than you allowed yourself to be exalted above it. In Bible terms, the mountains shall be brought low and the valleys shall be exalted. Such symbolic expressions are psychologically significant in this way. So in dealing with an earth stressed person, a cycloid, a manic depressive type, the important thing is to teach them not to be exalted. They feel fine, they say, why shouldn't I feel fine? I've been depressed for so long. The answer is, that is why. If you do not pull yourself down when you're exalted, you must fly to the equivalent depth to the height you've allowed yourself to be exalted. And if they practice, lots of people I know that were very cycloid in temperament in this manner have completely cured themselves. The ideal is to get that tendency to exalt, hardly to move over the median line, so it can't go below it. You then get an even keel of life. You've got self-control. And you know that if you get excited and flip up, pull yourself down. And you know that if you've allowed yourself up and managed to pull yourself down, you will be pleased that you've done it. So that when you become depressed later, you will be equipped in your memory with the knowledge that next time you're elated, you can pull yourself down a bit more and the depression will reduce. So the characteristics of those people are, they're pitched in the physical body, they tend to be cycloid in behaviour, alternately depressed and elated. The cure is pull down the elation, and then the depression cannot occur because of that physical fact. The water signs tend to be rather easygoing and pleasure-loving. They're the most pleasant people in the world to get on with, for other people in general. They're not always the best people for themselves, because it isn't always possible in this world to enjoy yourself all the time. But that is their campaign. The air signs tend to split, because of their analytical processes, into many little subsidiary entities, so-called split personalities. You can see the mechanics of that very simply in this sense. Suppose you study arithmetic, and then you leave it alone and study foreign languages, and you leave that alone and study music, and you leave that alone and decide you'll go to the pictures for relaxation, during which time you eat chocolate and bananas and so on, and then you come out and decide that it's time you went the pace, so you go and get drunk. And you do all these different activities, and you never find the common factor in them all. Now, if you don't find the link factor between these different activities, what you are really doing is engramming on your brain, Samson's, knowledges of certain fields of activity which are quite discrete. They have nothing to do with the other activities. So there's no link factor. And then when the nervous energy plays through those parts, it operates so that a man, one moment, he's a very, very rational being. That's because he's practiced being logical for a time. And then during the next period, he isn't rational at all, because the energy now has moved. It can't stay always in the same place in the brain. It must move. When it moves to another place, then the fellow thinks, oh, I think I'll do a bit of music practice now. And halfway through that, the energy moves to another zone. He thinks, I'll go to the pictures instead. This is caused by the movement of energies through the different zones in the brain. And you know, each zone in the brain has a specific function to deal with the actions of the body. So, the important thing for dealing with the schizophrenic type is to give him the link factors that tie together all the different activities. A man goes to a football match, and another man hates football and likes cricket. You say to both of them, after all, it's a ball game. And you start telling them that they've got 11 in both. There's 11 cricketers, 11 footballers. Why 11? Why is a cricket pitch twice 11 long? Why are there 3 stumps? And so on. All these games are symbolical. They're ball games. And all the ball games can be linked together as games which are really metaphors of activities of the will. Because ball means will. Be all means the whole. Ball. Ball, with an O in, is the Greek form and the Latin V-O-L, vol, volition. This is the ball, the circle. Energy comes in and turns round. That's ball. This one is called vol, as in vulcan. The gentleman that hides underneath volcanoes and hammers. This is vol, and this is vol. That is individuated volition. So that when we talk about ball games, we're talking about will games. And the whole object is to pass that ball through an arch of some kind, isn't it? So in this sense, this represents the initiative power. Freud would have said, oh well, it's just a male symbol. And the goalpost is a female symbol. In the case of rugby, we use a letter H. Because rugby is only for decent fellows to play, isn't it? Now, can you see, symbolically, why in rugby they have an H goalpost instead of what is in effect a chet?
It's a spirit sign,
isn't it? Well, it's a sign of spirit. Now, supposing you take this, it's the diaphragm. These games were made by kings long ago to train their children. There's your diaphragm in the H, you see, and a footballer kicks underneath it all the time. But the rugby man who's training to be a gentleman, he has to get the ball over the bar, doesn't he? He must keep the will up. Now this is a method of linking for the sake of these skitsy type of people, linking together what these ball games are about. They're all symbolic. It's not accidental that they have it in a certain game for a certain class of people, a certain number of players. It isn't accidental that the ball has to be kicked over in rugby and kicked under for ordinary folk. Now, the more you can think about ball games in that way, that the ball equals will, and it's a masculine sign, and the goal itself is a feminine sign, spirit itself is feminine, prior to creation, because the positing is the first masculine. You know, the Latin macula means a spot. If we put an S in it, mascula. You see, that is the same as the masculine side. Men are the original spots or blots on the scutcheon of spirit. They're thrown in, that is like the Hebrew letter Yod, which you would draw just like that. That's a Hebrew Yod, which is our jot in English that Christ refers to. Not one jot or tittle shall pass away. Here is the goal, you see, that's head, hedge, limit. This yod is a drawing of a hand like that, and it means creative power, and it means the positor. Posit is that making of the point, po sit, but po is power, and sit means you put your power down, let it sit. So this yod, or jot, the Greek yota, is the jot or tittle that cannot pass away till all is fulfilled, because as long as things exist, there must be positing of power. And as long as there is positing of power, then nothing can pass away. And nothing is going to pass away until everything has fulfilled its purpose, and therefore not one jot can go away till all is fulfilled. It's just a question of the logic of it. Now, are there any particular questions you'd like to ask about any aspects of the zodiac that might help to clarify any particular issues?
Well, I find that I've got most of the other symptoms or behaviour patterns that you give to the birth signs that aren't particularly in the way of my own.
In what way?
Well, I find I've got a little bit of the... one time I didn't anyhow. It looks bad now.
Mm-hmm.
Getting very late and up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Right down to the depths again.
Mm-hmm.
The other earth sign of changeability, start to do something and decide to do something else. I think I've had the lot in fact.
Well now, this is a diagram of a human being, isn't it?
Yeah.
And a human being has these four parts inside him. We've analysed them out and dealt with them separately. But to deal with a human being, we must put them all back together and synthesize the whole man.
Right.
You're a Pisces type, aren't you?
Yes.
That means you've got a primary stress there. But that primary stress, being an emotional stress, has tended to link you to all the others, hasn't it?
Yes.
You see that? So because of that stress, in a real sense, your mind is very quick internally. And you attach yourself to a lot of things, don't you? And have done. Emotionally. So, we must remember that the whole man has all these things inside him, and the difference between one man and another as regards this wheel is stress only. That is to say, you are not merely one of those. You are all of these. There is always 11 of those subordinated to one, unless a stimulus comes outside. You see, supposing we stimulate your Gemini faculty and ask you how long is a piece of string. You've got to think about it, haven't you? That takes you out of Pisces for the time being and stresses Gemini. You see that? In you. Because you've got them all. If we found an emotional being to act upon you, you would understand what he was doing. Wouldn't you?
Yes.
But because you're looking for wholeness, you may not like him.
True.
In fact, very often, the people that we are most like are the people that we like least. Because they haven't got anything to give us. Now, the funny thing about this is, very often, people marry somebody on the opposite side of the wheel. And when they have babies, they frequently bisect the angles between them. This is an attempt on the part of nature to equilibrate all the time. Supposing all the giants married giants and all the smaller people married smaller people, we'd have had two races, wouldn't we? Of the very big and the very little. What we find is that tall people are fond of little round people, you see, and fat people are fond of thin people, and dark people like fair people. This is a device of nature's to guarantee that the human race manages to remain human. Otherwise it wouldn't be a race at all, it would be a multiplicity of different species, wouldn't it? So we have to remind ourselves that this is only a stress. And then we must add to it this, you are also not only born at a particular time of the year, but you are born of certain parents. So you have your biological inheritance as well as your birth position to consider. Also, you have the fact that you are born in a certain country and there's a certain tradition acting upon you. And you're born on the earth, aren't you? Not on Venus or Mars. Your specific gravity wouldn't be the same if you'd been born on Saturn as it is now. You see that? So first we must consider all these different influences. First of all, you derive from the infinite spirit, which is called the Godhead. Then you're whipped into the macrocosmic sphere. And then you're driven through the sidereal sphere, through the solar sphere, through the planetary sphere, into the Earth. You've already passed a lot of influences on the way, haven't you? Then you get into a certain country on the earth, at a certain historic period on the earth, with a certain tradition, in a certain family, with a certain biological heritage, and on top of that, in a certain house of the zodiac.
Just ain't no hope for it.
That, you see, that you must handle it very, very carefully. A lot of people say, oh, well, we know him, he's a fish. Cross him off. He's emotional. Now, that's foolish. Because the character of the external stimulus Everybody says it will sometime, isn't it, right?
Thanks.
Subject to this number of influences, which you have to remember, they're all valuable, you know. It's the same if you're studying anatomy, you have to study the different structures, you say, start with the skeleton, and then you hang on to its various major muscle forms and some similes and so on, say artistically. And to draw a figure of a human being in action, you have to remember an awful lot of things to avoid mistakes. Well, when you're trying to deal with a human being, remember first, he belongs to the Absolute Spirit, then he came into the universe, he's subjected to astral or sidereal star forces, cosmic energies, then solar energies, planetary energies, earth energies, national energies, particular family biological, and then the time process on top of that, and then external stimulation coming from outside to complicate the matter. If you make allowances for them all, you can be very accurate. And if you ignore them all, except one, then the particular time you have to go. It's surprising how close you can get to it, though. Now, for instance, if you take even the century we're born in, we are born in the 20th century, in the first part of it, and the 19th century inertia is riding over us still. We still believe in atoms by inertia. Atoms are a fiction. We still believe in electrons. They're another fiction. A man like Schrödinger says, well, they're logically inconsistent with themselves. Perhaps they're just wavy calls. You see, he takes the word particle and cuts the part off and keeps the echo, and then he tags a wave onto it and says it's a wavy call because it behaves like a wave and like a particle. This is an attempt to put together contradictories to explain something that's inherently contradictory. And they're all myths, in any case. In that sense, the whole of science is a myth. But it's a convenient myth. If I tell you that Prometheus stole fire from heaven, to which the gods got very annoyed and sent him a wife named Pandora, but Prometheus means forethought in Greek, so he wouldn't have that wife. He said, not for me, thank you. If the gods had sent me a present after I've stolen fire, it must be no good. So he refused it. But he had a brother called Epimetheus, which means afterthought. So he married her. And then all of a sudden the world started. That is a mythic statement. It's myth. It is valuable. It says forethought can dodge a certain amount of trouble, but it gets you into another kind of trouble. Because Prometheus was bound to a rock, and then an eagle came and tore out his liver every day. And in the night time he renewed it. But the eagle came back and tore it out again the next day, because he was a man of forethought. Now if we go into the world of business where men are forethinking all the time, they're Promethean men. And we find that liver trouble is one of their chief troubles. Because forethinking has to do with the liver. And when you're forethinking, you are really annoying yourself in a variety of ways and sowing all sorts of fears in yourself. And the ego is the symbol of the intellect. So it is your intellect, your activity, that's biting at you. That's Promethean activity.
How about Liverpool in this situation?
This is an amazing thing, you see. We go into Manchester and all the buses are red. We come here and they're all a funny kind of greeny blue, aren't they? The same colour that you see on copper, and the same with the lamp standards, can't they? Now, copper is a metal sacred to the goddess Venus, the goddess of Venusicism, and the liver is very closely connected with that activity. It's part of the geodetic revelation. Who persuades the corporation to paint their lampposts and buses in the appropriate colour of Venus? Does the Lord Mayor know about it?
They were red at one time.
Who persuaded them to change them?
I don't know.
You know Mars and Venus are opposite.
Yes.
Did we do the planets in their pairs?
No.
Have we done that?
Can you have a spare paper?
Yes.
These are more on the one. They're part of the planetary influences, but they're very simple to learn and very, very useful, and a very, very good circle. We take a circle and say that represents all that is. We draw it again and put a cross in it to represent each that is. And then we say we'd like to represent two different concepts out of this, so we'll cut the circle in half, like that, and take the cross out and put it at the top and put it at the bottom. And we'll then make a quick cursive sign like this and like this. Now that is the sign of Saturn as a planet. That is the sign of Jupiter. When the cross is over the semicircle, it means time over eternity, or contraction more than expansion. When this semicircle is over the cross, it means the expansion is dominating the contraction. Saturn means contraction. Jupiter means expansion. That's one pair. You just do them again. Saturn, time over eternity, or contraction over expansion, expansion over time. That's one pair. Saturn, Sat is being, and the urn thereof. The urn that contains being. The idea is that when the contraction principle of the universe dominates, you have made an urn of being. But when the expansion dominates, you have made Jewish God, Peter, Father, Jupiter. That's God the Father, because the expanded condition is prior to the contracted. Remember, the uncreated state of energy is prior to the created state. So Jupiter is older than Saturn. Now Saturn is called Kronos by the Greeks, isn't it? Time. Time. Time is a word in mit, throughout, backwards, because it depends entirely on the emission of energy. The time process depends on energy emission. Saturn, Kronos, time is the same as Satan, the devil. He's in opposition with God the Father, but they are both half circles of a whole, which is represented in Christ. And the sign for Christ is the sign for Hermes Mercury. There we are, the horns symbolizing the unbounded, the circle symbolizing the bound, and the material principle, the cross, crucifixion. So that represents the horns of your power on your head. This represents the feeling of your chest. And that represents the fixation in the sexual energy in the lower body. So there's your three-part man. And that is Mercury. So if we like to say it, we can write an equation that Saturn and Jupiter equals Mercury. We can, if you want, just go like this. And that is a legitimate equation in that sense. Now, Newton borrowed it from Jacob Boehme and said, forces in opposition, contraction and expansion produce rotation. This Mercury is Mercuri, to run, round. Running round, there's the Mer and the Merci. Mercury means to run round, and the running round is always caused by a contraction and an expansion together. So contraction, expansion equals rotation. That's a pair, and this is an odd one. You'll see why that is odd. It hasn't got one opposite to it. We have another pair now. Venus, circle with a cross below, which means that the soulish substance, the fluidity of it, is superior to the bone or material fixation of it. That is the matter part. This is the soul. That's Venus. Therefore, she's concerned with feeling. That is passive. Circle with an arrow flying out is Mars, and that means active. We're in the merry, merry month of Mars at the moment, and therefore the forces in the earth are becoming active and tending to throw out their little shoots with red ends on them, waiting to grow. These two are a pair of passive, active. It's a method of analysing our universe. And we have another pair, the moon, which means body itself, and the sun. Moon, or luna, and sun, or soul. Now, this means body, and that means force, or that means will, and that means body. You can call it body. And force, or matter and force.
And what is the difference, excuse me, between the passive Venus and the body of the moon?
Well, here we're considering the fact that it doesn't do anything other than receive, and here we're considering that it exists and occupies space. Thus the moon aspect of that is that it exists and occupies a definite amount of space. The Venus aspect of it is that it won't move unless we push it. The Venus and the Sun differ. The Mars and the Sun differ in this way. Mars is always active. It's always flying out when a certain amount of energy has gone into it. You see? But this symbolizes the very concept of force quite independently of whether it has poured itself into something or not. So we now have three pairs and an odd one. And the odd one is the sign of the Messiah. Now, when God is sent to create, he creates in 6 days and then rests on the seventh day. Now, the seventh day for the Jews and the seventh day for non-Jews is not the same day. The Christians use the Lord's Day, Sunday, because it means illuminated, enlightened. The Jews use Saturn's Day, because it means material, cover. Now, essentially, the Yiddish type has his book which says, obey that thy days may be long in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. In other words, it's fundamentally materialistic. So Saturn is their favourite day. And Christians are supposed to be wanting to become enlightened, so Sunday is their favourite day. But the favourite day for other folk who know one or two tricks is Mercury's day, Mercury or Wednesday. The quick fellow's day. And the quick fellow doesn't have a materialistic outlook and is not particularly wanting enlightenment as such. He's quite satisfied with the material situation as it is, and that some people want enlightenment, because he's going to balance all of these processes. He doesn't want to be passive, he doesn't want to be active. He wants to be both when he wants to be them. He doesn't want to be conditioned, inertia, passive. He doesn't want to live by liking things passively. He doesn't want to push things about. He doesn't particularly want to be a material body. Hello, Dan. He doesn't particularly want to be a force. He wants to balance all the possibilities. To make the days of the week and look them. We've not got them in the order that they occurred in English here. That is Sunday, Monday, Mars is Tuesday, Tewis is the old Norse god of war, Venus is Friday, the old Frigga's day, Fruit Day or Payday. Mercury is Wednesday, Jupiter is Thor's day or Thursday, the Hammer's day, and Saturn is Saturday. And if you look at the logic of it, you can see that's why it is that people go making merry on Saturn's day. The Saturnalia, or whoopee time of the ancients. You start your day in a moony state in the working week after you've had a rest in your illuminated state on Sunday. Sunday is supposed to be devoted to illuminating yourself, remembering the Lord on that day. On Monday, you're supposed to start counting again, go back to business. The moon is the counter. Having counted, you're supposed to make war on all your rivals in the business world on Mars Day. On Mercury's Day, you're supposed to be well into the business field because Mercury is the patron saint of businessmen, rogues, thieves, vagabonds, and leg pullers. And on Thursday, it's getting late in the meet, so you have to hammer it to get your quota. On Friday, you get paid. That's fruit day. Saturn's day, you make whoopee. And that is the order in which your weekly round is generally conducted. And the funny thing is, it's conducted practically over the Western Hemisphere in the same way, and with very little modification in other countries. In other words, there's an inherent logic about it. Sometime in your life you should sit down and evaluate your position. That's your Sunday. Having found out where you're up to, you should then start the next day counting to see whether you've got the wherewithal. On the next day you launch forth and you aggress against the world to further your purpose. On the middle day, the Mittwoch of the Germans, you should be really spinning it, rotating the mercurial speed, really getting about like a traveller with 14 different zones up and down the country. See? Thursday, it's getting a little late. Your quota has not been... If you apply them all, you will have a very good evaluation of the situation, won't you?
What happens to the loss of time?
It doesn't affect this because the amount of error that occurs for using a year that isn't quite right is infinitesimal as far as an individual man is concerned. It is periodically corrected. You remember on one occasion 11 days disappeared from the calendar, and the poor people who didn't know that those 11 days hadn't really been stolen from time, just onto the calendar, took a lot of bricks and started throwing them on Whitehall and everywhere they could, demanding back their stolen days. They actually thought they'd had days stolen. Now, all of this, which might look complicated, isn't if you see the underlying logic of it. There must necessarily be to create a contraction. And what existed before the contraction is a state which, after contraction, you could call expansion. Couldn't you? Before you contract, you don't call that the expanded state. You might call it extended if you want. But expansion and contraction are logically opposite ideas which presuppose each other. Before contraction, there is that which is expanded. The expanded is prior and is therefore called Jupiter, God the Father. It then contracts onto a point, and that's the devil or Saturn. And this contraction or self-will is the same thing as ideation, individual value. And you have to balance the expansion of the absolute and the individuatedness of Saturn. That is, you have to be yourself, and remember there are other beings as well. See the logic and then restore the whole thing to this diagram. And it becomes simple. You've got contraction, expansion, and rotation. That's quite simple, aren't they? Then passive and active. That's passive pleasure, active desire. The Venus type is a blonde lady with not much energy, whose fingers press right back until you can touch her wrist with them, and she lives for pleasure. If you found one in pure time, be surprised. Mm-hmm. The Mars type of man has red hair, red skin, and a tremendously zealous nature, and he never waits. He goes bang for the target. You can find a lot of pure types of those, actually, more than the others. The moon aspect simply means the body as a material structure and the sun as a force acting upon it. So that's quite simple, really, isn't it? Contraction, expansion produce rotation. That rotation, considered internally, may be viewed as passive, and considered as squirting energy out, is active. Considered as occupying space, we call it a body. Considered as its original force, Jupiter, we call it a force, the sun. So really, those are not very complicated, are they? And we can reduce the 12 signs of the zodiac down to 4 systems in your body, your physical matter represented by the bone, the fluids in your body, your blood, etc., the air in your body, and the nervous energy in your body. Just 4 systems. In 3 phases, the undifferentiated before it gets in your body, the differentiated and unified when it gets in the body, and then the alternation between the two, the mutableness of the third state. So that the top state is like an absolute positive, then the contraction of it, which makes unity, is a negative, and the third state alternates, it's neutral, it goes absolute, particular. You find if you try to think, you have to think about a thing. If you try to think about a thing, you'll have to leave it. Suddenly I decide to think about that pencil. Thinking about it is saying what there is in it. I say, what is it? Well, it's graphite in the middle. What's graphite? Immediately I have to leave the pencil to think about it. That's why we say about. Ab, out, away from it. It's graphite in, because it's fairly easy to break, they put it in a piece of wood. What's wood? Trees. It's a piece of, I think that's a piece of Czechoslovakian pine, isn't it? Now, every time we try to think about a thing, we have to leave it and think about something else. And if we see the logic of that, we will never try to think about a thing without thinking about everything else. Because if we think, well, what is wood? It's trees. What are trees? They're kinds of beings that somehow are created by the action of the sun on air, water, and earth. Aren't they? Somehow, a force enters into the earth and drags up various chemicals and combines them with water and air, and that's a tree. So already it becomes a cosmic proposition to examine the pencil. And whatever it is, we should always force ourselves back to the universal origin in order to understand what it is. If we think inside our body, what is that? Absolute cause of all things, force. What is it in the body? It is willpower. So there's a definite relation between the willpower of a man and the Jupiter, or cosmic creative force, in the universe. But you cannot get at it as long as the rota, the inertia, the habit of you, is using up all your energy. If you're in the groove, if you're a dead man, you can't get the energy out of the groove to use it for another purpose. So there's a very simple test of whether you have got willpower or not. Simply take something you habitually do and don't. Take something that you always do and don't do it for a week. If you manage it, you can say, yes, I have willpower. If you forget about it, you can say, I haven't got willpower yet. But know that if you get it, you have got the same essence with Jupiter, that is, with God the Father. That is, with the cosmic original spirit.
Could you equate the sixfoldness with the twelvefoldness? You spoke about it at the beginning. You drew the first six, which you've spoken about, with the five sense organs. Could you show how the 12 arises?
First, we'll take this out, the Mercury, because it's the balance of all those.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we consider the contractive side is the part that produces matter, isn't it?
Yeah.
So this Saturn is related specifically to the bones. So why this thing, the skull, which is bony, we say it's a Saturnine compaction. All the bone parts are Saturnine. All the airy parts are Jupiter, the expansion. You see your lungs expand, don't they? Mm. The expansion tendency which sucks in the air is your Jupiter function. This Venus is fluid and so is the Moon. But this is the passive aspect of it. And this one is the spatial occupancy of it. So both those two belong to the fluids in the body, and Mars and the Sun belong to the nervous energy in the body. See?
Hmm.
So it's not really a complicated thing when you see the internal relations of them.
Hmm.
They've been spread out in this way to enable you to analyze the situation. You see a man with a certain kind of body, and his head may belong to a slightly different category. You find a man with the coloration of a Latin and the features of a Slav. Well, you can say straight away, his ancestry is mixed. We find some high yellow neguses that look exactly like Jews. Because once upon a time there was a medial type, the Shem type, from which there appeared a Yafetic or intellectual and a Hamitic or sensual. If we bring back the terms together again, we find that we're getting the middle that we started with. So you find a tremendously Jewish look about the high yellow neguses in America.
Mm.
In fact, you could easily mistake them for Jews, because they are really the products of bleeding back into the middle line from which they emerge. The thing is to see the fundamental simple line, and then all this stuff isn't complicated at all. There would be no bodies in the world if there weren't contraction. So Saturn is the very principle of materiality. And then immediately you see why it says in the Bible, the whole world is in the grip of the devil. That is, all matter, whatever, is a product of covetousness, grab. God the Father is expansion and is therefore always at war with Saturn. But Jesus Christ, the Messiah, is called the Mediator. And he tempers the severity of God, who wants to break up the devil's works, by explaining why it is necessary. So Christ mediates between God and the devil. The sin in man is apologized for, because it is the sin in man that keeps him separate. Sin means separation. If all men lost all separation, which would be the same as all sinfulness, the whole universe would suddenly splurge and there'd be nothing left. And there's no value in that absolute splurge. Therefore, a certain amount of devilishness is necessary. Sometimes you find little boys running about, and their mothers will say, they're proper little devils, those boys. And it means that they're initiating something and separating something and fiddling about and interfering. It isn't necessarily a bad thing. Actually, the only good is the whole, the mercurial resolution of all these oppositions.
Now, can we equate that with that sixfold division we had a few weeks ago, where we saw the universe first as a whole,
mm-hmm.
and we divided it, didn't we, into what we termed spirituality and materiality, and saw it as a dualism and a plurality?
Yeah.
Could you put that on for everybody?
No, I wouldn't do that, because that is a totally different frame of reference.
Yes, well, that's very
wonderful. It's a totally different frame of reference.
There is an equation, but it would only mix things up at the moment.
It would at the moment.
Yes.
The best thing to do is to familiarise yourself with the internal logic of this thing, and to see that in this sign, Mercury, we have a diagram of a man where he has pinned his sexual energies. He has his whole feeling, and he remembers his dual origin. Those horns up there symbolize that he's rooted in duality, the devil and God the Father. William Blake says the people on earth worship the devil under the name of Jehovah, and they don't know it. Why? Because Jehovah, God, is a creator, but a creator is a finiter, and we don't want finiting, we want freedom. But why do we want freedom? Because we haven't got it. If we had it, we'd want to be finited. The essential thing is to see that the Saturn-Jupiter opposition is no more than the split of a prime whole, or each split The triumph of each over all and of all over each. When all triumphs over each is Jupiter. When an each triumphs over all, it is Saturn. So we say that Hitler was the devil because he triumphed over the German people. He subjugated them to his will. Now, if they'd have subjugated him, we might have called it the tyranny of a bureaucracy or something like that. And it's very, very difficult to equate the many with their particular devil, because the mass itself seems to be its own justification and its own law. The herd makes the rules for the herd, and it always defines an individual who doesn't conform with herd law as a devil. Thus the Pharisees said of Christ, he hath a devil, because he's fiddling about with the Pharisaic law. We must put him on the cross where he belongs, the sign of the devil, nail him up. So that really when he's pinned on the cross, like Moses pinned the serpent up on a cross in the desert, it simply means the cross fixation. If that malcontent or dissatisfied fellow who doesn't like our rules, can be caught by us, we'll nail him onto the thing that he signifies, namely irritant form within the body politic. The Sanskrit word, the only word in Sanskrit for will, is itcha. Itch, the English word itch, irritant. You see, you get the welfare state, and some people think it's an ill-fare state. They start dodging. Now, the government will always define the dodgers as naughty men, but the dodgers will always define the government as a wicked, tyrannical bureaucracy. And the question is, who wins? The winner does the defining. And it's very, very important to realise that what we're dealing with is a whole, and continuously resynthesise this. You see, there is a man who has his awareness consciously that he's rooted in Saturn and Jupiter, in grab and let go. It's as simple as that. Grab, let go. Supposing a man grabs, he gets his penny. Sometimes your little boy's got a penny, it's in his hand. And he says, what have you got in hand? He says, a penny. Where are you going with it? Nowhere. Why? It's my penny. What pennies are to spend? He looks very suspiciously at you. You take him to a shop and you say, give this boy something for a penny. And he looks at his penny like that and he won't let go of it. And you say, but it's currency, it's supposed to run about. You've got to let go, otherwise it's useless. Now the boy has to learn that he can't get the value of the penny without opening his hand and letting somebody take the penny and give him something for it. It's this thing, grab and let go. And the important thing is, what are you going to grab and what are you going to let go? If you grab the wrong thing, you'll find you've let go of the other thing. And it's the ability consciously to grab the right thing at the right time and let go of the right thing to let go of, which you would call the wrong thing to hold, also at the right time. And then you've resolved this difference. And we call this the unfallen man, his horns are at the top. He's aware of the fundamental duality in man, that grab and let go is his origin. And he has in his feeling compassion for all beings, and he knows that all beings are crucified on their physical bodies. So he thinks in terms of a dialectical process, the identity of opposites. He feels compassion for the whole thing, and he knows that he's pinned on a physical body and so is every other body. That's called the unfallen man. Now we'll draw him in his fallen state. Now, he's pinned in his brain on ideas. He's now an intellectualist. He thinks that he can solve the universe in terms of thinking, and logical thinking cannot solve it, because logical thinking says that contraction and expansion are opposites, mutually exclusive, and nothing to do with each other. Logically, putting in and taking out are opposite, aren't they? Paralogically, beyond logically, dialectically, both processes are going on simultaneously in the universe. Energy is pouring in and energy is going out in the same moment.
the Atlantic cable that takes a message to America, down its core, is returning a current on the outer sides of the cover, isn't it? There must be circulation. Something is going down there, something is coming back at the same time. Now, we call that paralogical thinking. And the man that thinks only logically, we call him an intellectualist. Remember, IST means he's crucified. He thinks wholly, but now he's walking on two legs. You see? Let us say he's alternating as he goes along. One of his legs is a thinking leg and the other leg is a feeling leg. And he never knows, by thinking, which leg to put down first. We talk about getting up in the morning and putting your right leg down first. And some people are not quite sure whether you should put the left leg down first. Now, in India, where they systematized all this, they said, when you get up in the morning, put down on the floor one of your legs. If you're a Brahmin, put down your left leg in public. If you're in secret, put the right leg down. It means, the right leg means will, going willfully. The left leg means going with circumspection, or looking round about to see what's cooking. So when you're going through life, you have to look all the time. But if you've only got a thinker, a logical thinker, you do not know whether it is time to be willful or just think. When you're dealing with a person, you can't think whether to be willful or not at the moment with him, can you? Just impossible. You're almost invariably out of phase with him. You might try willfulness and he may hit back. You might try thinking, but he's sucking a lollipop at the time. He's not in his intellectual centre. So he can't respond. So this is the fallen man who is an intellectualist. That's like a diagram on the scientist. The legs of him are embedded, if you like, in the material world. And he doesn't know quite what to do about that, because he's a thinking man. And therefore he has to formulate a mathematical analysis of the world based on statistical survey. And he can never deal with an individual. He can only deal with large numbers of things simultaneously. But the unfallen man is aware that he's rooted in grab and let go, aware that the physical bodies of all beings are pinned, and his feeling is of compassion. And this fellow's feeling here is a whole feeling split by this. His thought process goes down there, and this is like the two lungs. Part of it says it's time to think, part of it says it's time to be willful. But he can never have enough data by thinking. But on the other hand, if you remember this, you can deal with the situation much better. If somebody is absolutely adamant about something, you know in principle that he's very, very soft about precisely that thing, otherwise he wouldn't hammer it so hard. If a man who's absolutely secure about a thing, he doesn't need to hammer it. So, this fellow, the mercurial man, if he comes up against a very dogmatic person, he knows mush is hiding under him. On the other hand, if he comes up against a man apparently mushy, he knows that if he pushes that man and takes his mush off him, he'll suddenly contract into a stone and grab and fight. So you find that apparently tolerant people, when you start trying to find out the limit of their tolerance, they're quite clear that it's so far and no farther. In a recent description, a historical one, it said in about the early 17th century, a group of intolerants, fleeing from intolerance, went to America to establish some more intolerance. Now, we know what we're talking about, the Virginians, the early settlers there. They could not stand the situation in England because the government was squeezing them. But the government was squeezing them because they wanted to squeeze other people, and they wanted such people in America to form the basis of a government. So they had to squeeze the people that wanted to squeeze, so that they'd fly away, like orange pips between the flies, and then rush off into another country and start doing the same thing on whatever beings were there. And they always do it in the name of the thing they are guilty of. So in the dialectical thinking, the paralogical thinking, whatever a person is, remind yourself that he's also the opposite at the same moment. And state it to yourself. When you become fairly sensitive, you can state it to him too. And he knows it. He might suddenly start grinning and say, well, and let go of it. In this method, you can't do it. If you try to think, you'll be statistical, and you don't know enough about that man with that colour, that height, to be able to predict his reaction. But you do know that all men are everything simultaneously. Therefore, whatever he says he is, maybe he is, but he's also a lot of other things as well. Quite opposite to the things he just said. The more you can see that everything springs out of grab and let go, because it's grab and let go together produces rotation which establishes beings. It's that establishment that gives this passive aspect and the body aspect. And it's the fact that the inpouring of the energy into it makes it squirt out like Mars and gives a force manifestation. So the more you can think about that, the more you will find that it's only an extension of that diagram of the cross in the circle, which is tremendously easy to handle once you've analysed it and then re-synthesised it together. See if you can equate these with the different signs in the zodiac. And later on, if you like, for instance, if you look in Genesis 49, you'll find the blessings of Jacob to his sons, and you will there find the characteristics of each of the 12 groups, the kind of people they are, and what kind of things happen to them. To remind yourself, put your mnemonics down on bits of postcard or something, pin them about the place where you know what they are, you know what they represent. If you put them down symbolically like this, you know what they are, nobody else does.
Good thing like decorating your room in a particular room.
Oh, yes, yes.
Mine.
A lot of my friends have got a special room. And the wall was done with symbols. So whichever way they look, they get a stimulus to do work. I did a very big one of the geometric relation of all the people I knew on one wall, quite a large wall, a quite plain wall. It's about as high as that and possibly a bit longer. And everybody who came in and looked at this thing was made ill. All it was a geometrical relationship of all the people I knew. And they were all furious about it. But the funny thing was that each person said, I like this one, but I don't like those. And they always picked out the one that represented themselves for liking. And they could feel these discordances. The whole thing was built up with the compasses. From the relations between those people. And done in appropriate colours, you see. So they had their natural colour sympathies there. But they didn't like it. None of them liked it. They only liked a little bit of it. It was just like real human beings.
Did this become a big circular pattern on the wall?
Well, it was made entirely of circles, but they weren't concentric.
No, but like cells around
that's
the
right.
Central one.
That's
you
right.
Would be the central one.
No, no, I didn't put myself in it.
Well, if this was to represent the relationship between you and these other people.
No, it's to represent the relationship that those people had with each other.
Oh, I see. Well, it would be hard to find the central.
Well, everybody thought they knew what was central to them. And they all disagreed about what was central. They all disagreed about their favourite colours. They all disagreed about which circle should go with which circle. Which should touch each other, which should intersect, at what angle. That's one of those topographical psychological things. only done completely with the compasses, nothing for him at all.
It must have given the result something like some of the modern art examples.
Well, some people who didn't know what it was thought it was modern art. I thought it was a mural painting in a modern manner.
You know, earlier you said that in the case of the person who becomes very elated and then very depressed, they shouldn't allow themselves to become too elated, hold themselves down.
Yeah.
Well, if they succeed and hold themselves down on the mean line, doesn't life become drab then? There are no lights and shades.
No, quite the opposite. That's what they're always afraid of. It's because they're afraid of that median line that they allow themselves to become elated. You see, they've got the wrong conception of that median line. That median line is tremendously vital. It's vibrating, right? It's not static. It tries to bounce up, you pull it down. And the funny thing is, every time you pull it down, you are pleased with your ability to do it. Because, you know, fundamentally, the only thing that pleases a man is the ability to do what he wills. Nothing else. So Nietzsche could say the only cause of sorrow in a man is the realization of personal impotence. And the only cause of joy in a man is realization that he can will. Nietzsche said that for a man, joy is I will. For a woman, joy is he will. That's a statement about active passing, isn't it?
So the blacks and whites are not lost.
No.
They'd be seen better.
Well, a certain Negro who's campaigning to remove the colour bar said if you play a tune on the white notes with no black notes, or a tune on the black notes with no white notes, it's not as good as a tune played on both. Gentleman called Agri.
Uh-huh.
Or Grey. In fact, they print it in all their Negro propaganda.
Do you remember once saying a pomegranate was, did you say the fruit of the Garden of Eden? Do you remember?
Well, you know that the name of the fruit is not given.
Mm.
When some people say it's an apple, some other people say it's a tomato.
Mm.
You see, the whole thing about the tomatoes is like a pomegranate in Europe, isn't it?
Mm.
The strawberries use inherently for the same idea. Well, the strawberries that the seeds on the outside simply means this idea of plurality. If you take a cup, sure enough. If you take a cup through an apple, you get this shape, don't you?
Mm.
And you're seeing from here. You get this threat of duality, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
In the section of it. In the case of the strawberry, the seeds are on the outside. The tomato is on the inside.
Mm.
And the pomegranate is the oriental equivalent. The pomegranate is used in the Orient, and the fig is used for the same reason, because it's full of seeds.
Mm.
The idea is plurality in unity. Adam means don't separate. And when he was created Adam, it means whole. But it was found that when he was whole, he was like a circle. He was no good to himself. So it says, God said, it is not good for man to be alone, all one. So he decided to take out from him the volitional aspect and leave him with the intellectual aspect. Namely, he took out a part, call it the woman, make it dark. This is full of secrets. And then the serpent comes along, that's a stimulus. Stimulates the will,
The will runs along and takes the intellect with it. Therefore, it says he went first to the woman. Hitler did the same thing in Germany. He talked to women first, knowing he once got the women on his side and go home to Abbey and say, "And Hitler's a fine fellow, get me into the party."
Well, the words used in the Bible there, as you've just quoted them now, might suggest that God made a mistake when he made man all one, and then he made a correction when he made woman.
Well, now, this is what the emergent evolutionists say. But a mistake means to take one thing for another that you didn't intend, doesn't it?
Yes.
But it couldn't be that, because when Adam was made, he was the first. Wasn't another to take a miss for him?
No, I meant, well, in error then.
Error means running away.
I have to find another word.
You have to find another idea, because, you see, first of all, we have undifferentiated energy, no creation whatever. Then we create. There's the zone of creation. Now, that's good. God saw everything that he had made on the first day, and it was good. That didn't stop him working on the second day, really. There is good, better, and best, isn't there?
Yes.
Now, this is good. That's good. You see, better is Beth Torah. Put a law in it. Beth Torah means house of the law.
So we set this rotation band going inside. This caps it into the 12 zones. As we mentioned before, that's called better.
But best means pure being established.
We put the cross in it. BST. Best, spirit, fixed.
So that's three stages. Good. Just making the substance better, putting a law in it, best, pinning it formally. That's the state. Now, on each occasion, he says, and God saw it was good. And when this, he works so far, because the will only works as far as it wants to, and it doesn't work any farther.
So at first, it worked like that, and it had made itself a ball.
Thought that's a fine ball. He thought, that was a good one. I'm going to start
cutting it up now, like this.
That's good division.
Well, I think I'll get it all nicely turning, like this. Get the whole thing fixed.
It's good, each stage of it. So if a man is doing a painting, first he gets a decent piece of paper, he says, that's good paper. Right there. Then he does some primary geometrical structures for the composition. That's good fundamental composition. Then he puts particular forms within it. Those are good. When those are all drawn, then he puts colour on top of it. They're all good in their own levels. So he doesn't make a mistake. He's not in error. First he makes a whole being, and then the whole being, which is free spirit, might undertake to create from itself. But he didn't. He wasn't under constraint, but he went to sleep like a spinning top. So he said, all right, it's a good piece of spinning top like that. We'll have a bit of something else as well. So he gave it another prong. He took a bit out. And thus established a polar relationship.
Does this mean that when God started to make the universe, that he foresaw what the result would be, or he didn't know, he was doing it to see what the result would be?
No, he knows. Like this. You see, first of all motions, supposing I say this white paper represents spirit, but you can't see the way it's bending. It's not static, it's highly dynamic. And therefore, it's full of motions wiggling about like this. We call it chaos, don't we?
Yes.
But that chaos is full of all conceivable motions, isn't it? If I stress one of them, there's one, you see. I begin to abstract a form. But that chaos is full of all conceivable motions, isn't it? If I stress one of them, there's one, you see. I begin to abstract a form. If I like to stress another one like this, there's another form of it, that's just a Durante, if you put an A in it, I think, and a hair on. This is only a question of stressing what already exists. For which reason it is said that God foresaw the world before it was made. And then when he spins like this, he makes inside there, and in this rotating activity, again the overlapping and intersection of forces inside here makes the possibility of special stresses like this, doesn't it?
Yes.
The moment you stress what is, there appears an emergent, an individual, but nothing new. There is no new thing under the sun, but there are new ways of stressing things. So the God, the Absolute Spirit, foresaw in himself everything that could possibly be created, and then he stressed some of it, and that was creation. And he stresses internally, continuously, new stresses. And the appearance of new stresses we call evolution. But nothing can be stressed that doesn't exist. This means that for every individual man, there is an eternal form. Actually, a man exists as a baby forever, and as a child, as a youth, as a man, as grown old, as dying. Forever, in all his phases. When he has stressed them all alternately, then he understands himself. Then he holds the whole concept of himself as born, dead, and in between. And that is his being. Christ says every man goes into his own place and his works follow him. Because death is only the removal of a certain kind of stress and the putting on of another kind of stress. This is why Paul says, really, there is no death in the sense in which people imagine. There's no annihilation of whatever is. Whatever is can never cease to be. Whatever is not can never come to be. But all you can do is stress it, which merely means activate the will in that place a little more. A poltergeist phenomenon exists. No scientist today would deny it. A vase picks itself up and is flung against the wall. Why? It's only power stressed in a certain way. Maybe there's a little girl there and she's not allowed to throw vases about and she wishes she could. And she goes into a sort of stupor with herself and gathers her enemies together, takes it over to the vase because fundamentally it's identical with it, and putting her frequency by sympathy of feeling at the same number as the vase, she suddenly displaces it. She's altered the stress. Those things can happen only because the universe is fundamentally force. Energy. There isn't anything that isn't made of force. When force rotates its matter, when it translates without rotating, we call it a force, a cause. So there aren't any mistakes for God. We can make mistakes. That's like putting your hand in this pocket for a pen and bringing out one. That's an engineering pen. I unscrew it and start writing, and suddenly ink runs all over the paper. Why? Because it won't write unless it's full. If it gets half full, it starts spilling. It's a fault of the pen design. The manufacturers know about it, and they can't cure it, and they warn you about it. Keep it full. If you allow it to get half full, it starts leaking. That's because it's got a special kind of feed. It's the only pen that will take in the ink. But if I forgot and thought I had filled it when I hadn't, and decided to write on my knee, I'd make a mess. That's a mistake. You take one thing amiss for another.
Well, when I used the word mistake, what I meant was, didn't God foresee when he was making man that it would be necessary for there to be woman as well? Did he wait until afterwards and then see that it was necessary?
Woman was in man, in Adam, before she was taken out. Adam was made in the image of God, male and female. That is a hermaphroditic structure. He could have operated on himself if he had willed. He was a free being.
but he didn't will to. As his wife had said in tradition, he had a wife before Eve whose name was Lilith. And because he had Lilith, he refused to work. You know what Lilith means?
No. Oh, Lilith.
Lilith.
Yeah.
Lilith was his wife before Eve was taken out of him. Lilith was Eve inside him, and it meant to say that he was getting sensual pleasures inside himself by playing with his own will and intellect instead of expressing. Lilith means to play with oneself. Now, there's a lot of people today that are Lilith-ridden in that sense. In magical parlance, we'd say they've got a succubus. That is, somehow they manage to use that energy, but they never do anything. Actually, they're doing it inside. They've got this peculiar faculty of sensually pleasing themselves and titillating their imagination with their own will. And it's called Lilith. Very naughty girl, Lilith. And when God saw what Adam was doing, he said, oh, I'll take Lilith out. Change her name from to play to develop. Chava or Eva, Eve, means to develop. You see, so when she's called woman, he said, and she was called woman because she was taken out of man. You know, this war man means out man. Pinch off him, his sensual, volitional side, and leave his intellect where it is. And then the will get into trouble when the stimulus comes and drag the intellect with it, and he'll have to do something. Well, as many a person gets trapped by internal sensuality like that. You can pick them out very, very easily. They've got dreamy eyes and a certain amount of introversion, and they never make anything on the outside, and a lot of people think they're very quiet. But they've got a universe inside, and all of it fun and games. And they're literally thrilling.
What's going to do with Leaf, that belief? We'll take a couple of Leaf.
Sleep. Pleasant dreaminess. It's a piscatorial tendency.
Yeah.
Lilith. But it stops working now. Stops development. Because you can actually construct inside yourself a wonderful, fantastic, and delightful universe without ever getting related to any reality outside yourself.
So it's almost like the taking of drugs, then.
Actually, the people that take opium are going into contact with Lilith by an artificial method.
Mm.
You see, they can't concentrate sufficiently like some people born in certain positions can do naturally. Some fellows can sit down and have an opium dream without the slightest effort. Without opium. You see, now the name of opium in Latin is papaveda. And it means the father as a sexual symbol and the mother playing about in the imagination. And it's that internal process. Actually, that naughty old boy, Aleister Crowley, recommended it as a pastime for certain of his female followers. When they were not physically very attractive, he taught them this method. If they're physically attractive, he taught them another method. But for those who wanted to learn, he taught them this method. That is, how to imagine themselves as man-woman, internally, and have a relationship with themselves. The result was that they lost all external initiative, and thereupon he took their checkbooks, put them in their hands, put a pen in, and said, write, pay Aleister Crowley. And they wrote, and he went away, came back and gave them another lesson. And they thought it was worth it. Some of the old ladies that I know were members of the organisation, you know, the Dawn thing, and the Women of the Trees, both of which he initiated in London, although there was a rival claimant in Germany for certain aspects of the Golden Dawn. Some of those women at 60 and 70 who were still interested in sexual activity to the point that they would be prepared to learn that technique and pay for it. And it was just encouraging fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
and ever becoming more and more and more passive, more and more subject to his will, because he taught them how to do it.
Easy ways to make money.
Well, it's easy, but the question is, do you like the kind of job that it is?
No.
Mm-hmm. One of the easiest things in the world, all you have to do is just hire yourself to May the Veil, put a sign on the door, Lilith, a sporting tour. Mm-hmm. You get immediate buyers.
To overcome that, then you need actually the correct stimulus, don't you?
Yes. External stimulus, an application on concrete things. Take any concrete thing like that and universalize it. Try and find out its source. No matter what it is, use the external. Because if you don't, you're locked up in yourself in a fantastic world. And the end of it is that you become depleted of the best method is to take concrete material things like that and deliberately trace their source in the material world, right through from the particular end to their earth origins, their cosmic origins, back to force, and then start on another one. The Buddhists use simply a piece of clay. If they find anybody with a certain type of expression in the eye, they put a piece of clay in his hand and say, meditate on that. It is clay. And he has to think about it. What am I supposed to do about clay? Or what is clay? Earth. What is earth? Well, earth, according to the astronomical theories, was once upon a time liquid, not solid. Before that it was a gas. Before that it was incandescent. A body of light. So somehow that dark clay is only light made dark. How has it become made dark? By compaction. Too much grab. Too little grab, you've got an ocean of light with nothing in it. Too much grab, you've got darkness. Somewhere between, in that vibration, the mercurial resolution, you have light dark, chiaroscuro, the great relation, the possibility of real value. You get a picture on white paper and paint it in white paint. It's a good picture, but you can't see it. That's what God used to do before creation. He's painting light on light. And the devil said, well, I'll paint in black on black, just to be awkward. So Mercury said, well, I'll paint in black on white and white on black, and resolve it. So the Mercury man is a fellow that knows the rooting of everything in this opposition and utilizes it.
Means the Mercury man can change his viewpoint from one side to the other.
Mm.
That's what it really means, isn't it? Changing his viewpoint.
Oh, yes. See, there's a very old Chinese saying which says, if you knew the truth, the real truth, and you knew it only in one way, it wouldn't help you except in one condition, in one time and place. So you've got to know the truth from every conceivable angle.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to get elasticity, otherwise you're useless. Many a technical expert cannot resolve the most elementary problem because he lacks the external stimulus of apparatus that he's used to. If you give him a piece of cotton and sealing wax, if he were able to get down off his high horse, he could arrange that thing in such a way to get a similar effect. But he doesn't remember, because he's too technically trained. In one direction. Come off that horse and get another horse. Get all the horses that are and ride them off.
To do that universalizing, who said that if you did it properly once, that would be sufficient? If we do it unclean times, because we've not been doing it properly, so learning how to do it.
Well, it isn't so much that. You can do it once properly, and immediately afterwards, you will discover you're back in your ordinary physical consciousness, because of the fact of the mass inertia of your previous thought. You've done it quite correctly, but you cannot maintain it unless you transmute the body. See, by special efforts you can get a flash and you can see the whole truth, and then a few seconds afterwards you can't be quite sure that you've seen it, but you know that you've seen it, and somehow it's not as bright as it was. It's simply the fact that the body has got to be reconditioned and made fine enough to receive that light all the time, instead of by special effort.
What happens when it lasts a matter of days? Say this particular time of the year, which is building up to a period, say at Easter, mm-hmm. when there becomes, or just after illumination, which might last for quite a length of time.
Well, there again, the external environment is conspiring to give it to you. It's not your work. See, the environment is giving it to you.
Yes.
That's the time to take the flood leads on to fortune. But the point is, can you restate that condition when it's not Easter? Easter is the yest time, the uprising time. It's easy to be optimistic in the spring.
Mm.
Everything is conspiring with you. Can you be optimistic in the winter? You know the Chinese say...
As you say, doesn't Shakespeare talk about the winter of discontent?
Yes, now it's the winter of discontent. Mm. Glorious summer. The point, this is again dialectical thinking. You take your bow and see broiled duck, this Chinese gentleman, don't you? The thing is, you can go too far. Actually, that bow is broiled duck, potentially, if you're a good shot. And there's a duck about. And it's the season of ducks. Otherwise, you're wasting your time with the bow, aren't you? So, the point is to get the instrument that you have and look for the right time and work while it is light, like working on the concept of the resurrection at Easter time. See? Work while it is light means work when nature is conspiring with you. Because at first, the winter will come and you cannot work so optimistically because it's miserable weather. But after a time, you gain the ability to work when it is dark. But that isn't a man, because it says the night comes when no man can work. That intellectual fellow, the upside-down man, can't work, except in the right situation. But the man with the horns, the dialectical horns, can. Because he says, if winter comes, can spring be far behind? Because he understands the cycle of events. So when he sees a snow landscape, he sees seeds underneath the snow hiding and warmed, protected by the snow. So he looks underneath the superficial darkness to those potentials hidden. And he knows by the law of cyclic activity that because winter is here and no thing can persist, therefore there must be none winter following. So spring must come, the martial force must shoot out. A lot of energies are poured into the earth in summer, aren't they? In autumn, the earth is full of energies, and then they hide in the seeds, don't they? The fruits are falling off the trees, the seeds are in the ground, the snow covers them up, and underneath they're waiting for the stimulus from outside that's going to hit them again when Mars, the ram sign, comes in, the energy council, the cosmos, the solar forces come, bang into those seeds. The melting snows swell the jackets, the energy goes inside the burst, and the shoot comes up. Sir John Barleycorn cycle, which is another example of the messianic winter crucifixion and resurrection in the spring. The whole thing is a cosmic cycle. The agricultural corn cycle is borrowed from the cosmic cycle. Some anthropologists think it's the other way around. They think that man first made a corn cycle and then thought cosmically about it. And cosmos existed before the corn cycle.
What is the best way to get back into that state, having experienced it a number of times, particularly at periods like Easter, and then to find yourself I suppose in a state of fall again, I'm not understanding it.
Well, the best thing is when you're in it to watch like mad what kind of feeling you've got and observe it so cleanly that you can remember the feeling. So that later, when you've gone out of it, you have a memory that you had a feeling of a definite type.
I'd say the effect it had on me when I done it, and that is that I know I can get back into it, but inertia says, well, it'll do tomorrow. I can remember it with that.
Yes.
And then if I make a big effort to do it, I find that I've got to make an even greater effort than the one I thought necessary. And it can be done, but it...
can be done.
But at that particular period, it's easier to do it. That's the way I've experienced
it. Remember that there is a force in the universe, that compression force, the centripetal force, pressing onto the centre and trying to persuade you to generate physically. And that is your physical mass inertia. What it wants you to do is have a lot of physical babies. There's another force, but it's of a totally different frequency, calling out those people who are ready to come out. But at this period of macrocosmic history, the forces are still going in. Because the object of the world soul is to generate a plurality of free beings so that they can have relations of a very high order. But you can't have a plurality of free beings without having a large number of bodies to serve as vehicles for training. And those bodies have got to be made, and free beings don't like tying themselves down. Therefore, there is a structure in the universe called Maya, the grand illusion, which makes everything in the spring look slightly different. This is a halo put around things. It's a trick inside the nervous system, you see. Thereupon, people are tricked into generating the physical bodies which will serve as vehicles of experience for souls to become free. Now, there's got to be a very definite number of such bodies made over a cycle of years. Somebody's got to make them. If you see the light by special effort, well, then the forces that want you to make physical bodies will try to pull you down again. And they'll say, well, the light's always there, why have it today? And they'll have wonderful explanations about why you shouldn't bother to go back into the light.
Because it's eternal.
It's always there. St. Augustine expressed it in his autobiography by saying a prayer, O Lord, deliver me from the concupiscence of the flesh, but not today. And he writes those words in his autobiography. And he was a great psychologist and self-searcher. And it was a genuine prayer. He was fed up with that generation cycle. You know, there's a three B's of St. Augustine represent his life story. Three B's. Born, bothered, and bishop. It's the same with St. Francis. St. Francis became a great saint because, first of all, he'd been a great sinner. If you do enough naughtiness, you begin to become convinced that it's not worth it. And that's the people that never do it are never sure that it's not worth it. And that's the meaning of the prodigal son. And if you say that to some people, say, oh, but well, I'm going to go and be a prodigal then. If that's so. But they're using your words as an excuse for weakness. They can't do it. And then if the first time they get into trouble, they come and they say to you, it's your fault, you told me to do so-and-so. I can give you an actual concrete example. One evening in a group like this, I made a general statement about the prodigal son, a quite general statement, that prodigality was not a bad thing in itself, and that for many people it accelerated their development because they could give things up quicker than they would otherwise give it up. But this was always a matter for an individual to solve. You see? And about 6 months later, a fellow came to me and he said, do you know that you're responsible for my girlfriend? She's going to have a baby. I said, why? He said, because of that stuff you said about the prodigal son. You see? And he was quite annoyed about it. And he was very sincere. He thought he'd been led up the spout by encouraging prodigality. And I said to him, most of the prodigals I know are very, very careful about that kind of result. But he actually was very, very annoyed with me for mentioning the prodigal.
Well, they accelerate something, certainly. a new being.
Well, it actually accelerated him wonderfully. And his wife. It accelerated him into marriage, a thing he would never have done otherwise.
That's what you would call an object lesson.
Oh, yes. Very objectionable lesson, David. But it did him good in the end, you know. I mean, the end up to now. Finally.
Will you excuse me now?
Yes, of course.
I have to push off.
Couldn't possibly visualize it.
How can you actually use that particular method to attain attendance, to help to attain attendance?
Well, first of all, you cannot see that unless you manage to stop thinking for a period. See, the thing that stops people from getting at that light, which is eternal and permanently there, we're in it actually, it's another frequency, is fantasy and ideation. That means to say you've got all the formulations in your mind, all formulations of feeling and idea, are the things that block you. Yes. So that the precondition of seeing it is, first of all, you must eliminate from the mind ideas. That's why in yoga is a suppression of vrittis, of mental modifications. That's the Patanjali definition. It's still the only valid definition there is. Stop the mind working at the lower levels, and the top levels will be seen because they're there. Now, the obstacle, the chief obstacle to this is falling asleep.
Yes.
Falling asleep. It isn't a question of stopping the mind thinking and falling asleep. You've got to stop the mind thinking and remain awake. The tendency is to fall asleep. In order to practice it, you take a stream of thoughts, no matter what it is, and you deliberately try to stop one thought getting away from you and stop the next associated thought coming in. And you've got a space between the two. Try and increase the space. We use the example of a horse and a cart. There's a horse and cart there, and a man comes, unharnesses the horse, and takes the cart away. Well, the cart has been taken away by the man. The horse runs away, leaving a space. And you try to hold that space. Just hold it, blank. But you're terribly alert. And you'll feel ideas trying to get in. No. Keep that space. If something comes into that space, start again. Put your horse in the car.
It's the point of coming to a certain extent, Jesus, with a picture for you. There's a house next door. The house is the words and the talking going on inside.
It's all ideation. Talking is also ideation.
And so what has happened, I've actually got to a state where it's actually my consciousness really, and I've come back, floated back out of it. I found out without talking, now it's only guessing, it seems to have continued and been going on all the time, even though I wasn't there. Now, whether it's actually started again from where?
No, it's going on all the time.
You leave it and you come back and it's still going on.
Everything goes on all the time because everything that exists is eternal. What you're doing is changing your phase. When you can't hear it, you've gone out of its frequency range. That's all, but it's still talking there. Do you know, every word you've ever heard in your life is sounding on its own all the time. And every sentence, which is a combination of words, is also sounding, because all the words that constitute your vocabulary are vibrating all the time.
As one?
Yes, as one whole. Yes.
According to the particular opening you make within yourself, that's what you receive, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What you do is you stress a thing, and it's your feeling that determines what you will stress. Now, the thing you like, the thing you dislike. The thing you like, you tend to move towards. The thing you dislike, you tend to be afraid of, and it presents itself. But talking is still ideation, it's still formal presentation.
You have to take the sentence and widen the
words at
the same time.
It's the kind of exercise that we start with. You say to you do it now, you see. I will say to you a series of numbers, and you mustn't hear the last one that would logically follow. So I say, twice we are.
Look, it's hard to see whether you've done it or not. That really has jumped in. I'm not actually.
Did you manage to keep it out?
No, I can't say that. There is a tendency sometimes. I tell you what, I find it hard to tell you whether I said it or not. In fact, quite often I find myself stressing it in my throat, you see.
Now, that kind of laryngeal reflex,
you see. But I don't know if it was there in the mind or not.
It's a question of levels, you see. When we talk about prayer, there's three levels of prayer. Audible prayer, where you can hear the words coming out of your mouth. Inaudible prayer, where you can feel the reflex in your larynx. And silent prayer, which is still a form, but there's no reflex here. And there's no sound out of your mouth. But you can hear the form of it in the mind. But there's no physical reflex. It's a different level, it's a different frequency. Then if you take the meaning of that prayer and contract all the words together and retain significance without serial expression, that's the fourth kind.
Oh yes, I know what you mean. Yes.
That's taking significance instead of serial expression.
So I say happiness and just feel happiness, you see, instead of with no particular word.
That's right, you identify with the significance of the term. Now, see if you can do this again. We will recite the alphabet. Don't you hear the next letter when I stop? A, B, C, D, E. Did you manage to suppress it?
No, it came off. I can't say that I would. Now
you see, you should be able to stop it so that you don't know what comes next. Otherwise, it's still inertia, it's still mechanics.
It was happening without my intention when it came up.
Well, it's quite mechanical, it wasn't your intent. Your intent could be the opposite, but it would still come up unless you're tremendously alert. Don't let the final word come in this. Rule Britannia, Britannia rules the.
I said monkey instead.
You said monkey, that's a device, you see. But did you notice that the monkey that you inserted was a jumping monkey like the wave motion? What you did is abstract jumping from the wave and turn it into a monkey to avoid the word wave.
Yeah.
That's still mechanical association of ideas. See? Now this is an exercise you can do on yourself and you can do on each other as an exercise, and really try, prepare yourself, because if you get prepared and you get a pal to try you out, you can gain this ability to chop it, and you just don't know the alphabet anymore. The Emma at Strangeways prison in Manchester has a wife, and I was talking to him one night, we were having supper with him, and he said, my wife's a yoga, you know. And I said, is she really? And he said, yes, she's terribly good at it. She's read all about it. She's very, very good at it. So I said to her, have you done that exercise of emptying your mind? And she said, yes, which one? So I said, the one about the horse and the cart, where you let the horse run away when the man takes the cart away and there's nothing there. She said, what is it? I said, well, see if you can do it. And he interrupted and said, of course she can do it. She's practiced yoga. I said, well, we'll see if she can. I said, now imagine a horse and cart, and a man comes, he harnesses the horse, takes the cart away, and suddenly the horse runs off. And there's a space there. Can you do that? And she went, oh, you should have a man to hand the car. You see? It gave her a terrific shock. It would have given him a shock too if he had seen which man. It wasn't him. See? It was another man. A threatening figure. One of the many convicts that she'd noticed that he had to deal with. Because being a convict is not necessarily being so wicked that you're positively horrible to look at, you know. Some of them are quite good looking. And the threat of violence is there. So he was behind the cart waiting till hubby'd gone away to MO things.
He was actually imprisoned within herself.
If you do that exercise with each other, you can go ahead very, very quickly. It's hard to work on your own. Get somebody to say something with a natural, logical sequence, and you try to chop it so that you just don't know. And don't try and put a monkey there. That's still a mechanical association of ideas.
The point is, I've got to follow you all the way, each letter.
Yes.
But the point is, I find this. You're saying A, B, C, D. You're going at a certain speed where I can't tell whether I'm actually presupposing or not by the time you've done your next letter, you see. When you stop, I'm not even prepared.
Well, you mustn't hear anything before me during the exercise. There must be nothing in your mind except the things that I say, and then when I stop, you must stop thinking.
That would be a good thing to get up and over here.
Oh, yes. The lower and more forward your consciousness, unless you can do it. Because there's an awful lot of associative mechanism down here, fundamental ideas, that works tremendously.
In the word association exercise, can you start to get used to it and able to carry on for longer?
Oh yeah.
Oh, I seem to notice that.
Yes, a very good exercise with words is this. You know, every word is built of primary letters, and only primary letters coexist eternally as forms. So that every word in every language is merely an outgrowth, an expression, pressing out, of a fundamental geometry of the universe which exists simultaneously. That means that all words in all languages are related together in a very definite manner. So when you look at a word, see if you can see another word inside it. Take it out and know that if it's in, it's got a logical relationship to that word. Let's take the word word. Inside the word word is the word war, W-O-R, as in worship, you know, worship. It has a very definite relation because you can't worship without words. If you look up this prime root, this W-R root, it means a power differentiating, illuminating its parts. There's also O-R-D, which is the root of order, and you can't make order without words. There's also O-R, which is gold, isn't it?
Gold.
Gold. Or is gold. And gold is the same thing as will. Gold is a symbol of willpower. So inside the word there is a principle of order, a principle of worship, and a principle of will, and the will is hidden in between. Will is hidden in the middle. That means that every word you've got really conceals in it a will. That means it tells you, if you analyse it, there's something you can do. Take a short word like cat. What does it mean? What is a catastrophe? What is a pussycat? The Greek word cat means fixed. The pussycat is so called because it sits in fixed attitudes, and when it moves, it suddenly takes the whole of its concentration from one place and puts it on another. And it fixes its attention. We know that. It's called cat because it fixes itself. Now this fixing is the same thing as cutting off, isn't it? Take the vowel out and see. KT sound is the fundamental concept, cut. The cat does that. It forgets all about you, and it sees something down there. Some people think the cats are very queer. The Egyptians thought they were sacred. There's a cat that can be looking at you and you give it a look, something goes. It stares in midair and people go, that cat has seen something. That's a frequency that human beings don't see. It really has. It's got a totally different gamut of vibrations in its awareness to a human being. You know that when the big earthquakes occurred in South America a few years ago, 2 days before it blew up, the animals migrated. They all left. And the human beings were saying, there might be all the animals running about with stupid things. What are they being excited about? The first day, all the animals cleared up, and towards the second day, and all the birds flew. That's funny, isn't it? The birds went after the runners.
I'll be off too, that's all.
You see? And there they all said, there's some old animals coming. So there was a big bang. And the whole place was buried in a few hours. Now, who told the animals? The fact is that the forces in the earth that were ready to blow up were beating at very, very high frequencies. And the animals could feel that terrible proximity of an explosion. It was real. They didn't see the future. They saw the present condition of imminence. Terrible vibration in the earth and in the ether when all these intermagnetic forces in the earth were crushing the strata underneath. They could feel this emanating. They thought, I think it's time to go. And they went. They just went. That reaction is the same thing as intelligence as far as animals are concerned. Providing they're in their natural habitat, its survival value is perfect. And human beings, upside down, thinking, as it should be said, can't possibly blow up, you know, because statistically it hasn't blown up before. Statistically, it says times plus times to one that it will never happen again. It hasn't happened at all yet. The statistics ignores that it's always the first time. There was a magnificent film of the Mexican one. Did you see it? They managed to get on the spot with cameras.
Oh, yes, I did.
And a mountain was thrown up in a few hours. A colossal mountain, 3,000 feet, wasn't it? It just grew like this. And the bridge disappeared. And
that's right.
Everybody's rushing off in all directions. And after it had been put up in a few hours, the geologist said, we shall have to modify some of our time scale about the formation of the Earth's crust. You know, they have some wonderful ideas of how long it takes to raise a mountain range, 3,000 feet high. It takes a long time. It's about 4 hours, I think, it threw itself up in its major mass. And they were surprised. So they wrote it down in the book, Modification of Statistical Survey.